On July 3rd, 1929, lawmen and townspeople crowded into an adobe mansion in Taos, New Mexico. Bluebottle flies buzzed all around, and the stench of death hung in the air. A decomposing body lay on a cot, and it was just a body. The severed head lay in a room nearby. The crowd's opinion was that the corpse and head belonged to the mansion's owner, Arthur Rochford Manby, who's been described as an odd amalgam of cultivated English gentleman, secret society adept, and vicious robber baron. He was all that and more. Manby had made himself one of the town's most feared and hated citizens after his arrival in the 1890s. Few mourned his demise. Nestled below the snow-capped Sangre de Cristo Mountains, Taos has exerted a powerful influence on artists, writers, and others for generations. Georgia O'Keeffe, D.H. Lawrence, and Aldous Huxley all found inspiration there, as did the psychoanalyst Carl Jung, who saw in Taos a manifestation of the fabled Magic Mountain. Arthur Manby's inspiration had been to possess the land, all of it. He spent 3 decades in a desperate and murderous campaign to achieve this aim, in part through something called the U.S. Secret and Civil Service Society self-supporting branch. Manby claimed his society was an authorized auxiliary of the U.S. government. Its purported job was to combat nameless evils that regular authorities couldn't or wouldn't handle. Manby invited well-to-do citizens to join the society. Refusal wasn't an option. And new members quickly learned what the self-supporting meant. They were ordered to fork over money, deeds, and mortgages. Manby promised that the federal government would reimburse them many times over. That never happened. Also, once you're in, there was no getting out. Not alive, anyway. To make that point, Manby initiated new members in a Masonic-style ceremony that graphically displayed the punishments, including beheading, that would befall anyone who betrayed their oaths of silence and obedience. One Taos resident named Cecil Ross enlisted in Manby's organization just to learn what it was about. He soon discovered that Manby had his fingers in bootlegging, extortion, fraud, robbery, and murder for hire. Ross recalled accompanying Manby once to an abandoned mine. Manby sat in front of a blazing fire. At his feet was a carefully arranged skull and crossbones, real ones. Inside the mine was an altar with more skulls and a box full of rattlesnakes. Investigators later discovered that Manby had a private boneyard where he dumped his victims, all of them headless. So you can see why almost no one was sad to see Manby gone. In this lecture, we're going to look at uniquely American secret societies. That includes literally hundreds of lodges, mystical orders, and fraternal organizations, some national, others purely local. Most sprang up during what's known as the Golden Age of Fraternalism, from 1890 to 1930. At the turn of the century, an estimated 1/3 of American men, and many women, belonged to some oath-bound order. During the 1920s, membership increased to 40% of the adult population. The United States had more lodge brothers than the rest of the world combined, accounting for more than half of the world's Freemasons. Millions more were affiliated with Odd Fellows, Red Men, Woodmen of the World, Knights of Columbus, B'nai B'rith, Elks, Owls, Eagles, and the Moose. Some societies were devoted to fellowship and mutual aid. Many had a distinct ethnic, class, or religious flavor. Others promoted political and social causes ranging from prohibition to white supremacy to black separatism. Even after decades in the American West, Arthur Manby remained an Englishman at heart. And it almost goes without saying that he was a Mason. He also belonged to 2 expat British societies, the Patriotic League of Britons Overseas and the Legion of Frontiersmen. The Legion formed in 1905. Billing itself as a field intelligence corps in the service of the British Empire. Its members claimed to be civil, self-supporting, and self-governing, just like Manby Society. I doubt that's a coincidence. And Manby had other models to work from. For two centuries, the Taos area had been home to Los Hermanos Penitentes, or simply Penitentes. They were the remnants of a medieval Spanish cofradía, or confraternity, of penitents and flagellants. Their ritual was a mock, or real, crucifixion each Easter. Persecuted by the Spanish Inquisition, the Penitente Brotherhood found sanctuary in the New World. Brothers met in lodges adorned with skulls and crossbones, much like those in Manby's Cave. The Penitente's Hispano-Freemasonry exerted a subtle but powerful influence over local life. Something else that must have influenced Manby was the most powerful secret society of the day, the Ku Klux Klan. The 1920s was the peak of its growth and power in America, a time when the invisible empire claimed 10 million members. The reality was probably half that, but the KKK was still the biggest secret society around. In 1925, 25,000 Klansmen paraded down Washington's Pennsylvania Avenue in full regalia. The Ku Klux Klan is so notorious that it's fair to ask what more can or needs to be said about it. Well, two things about the Klan are often overlooked or forgotten. The first is that there wasn't one Klan, but three, and they weren't identical. The second is who or what inspired and influenced them. For instance, why the obsession with K's and goofy names? And what's with the white robes and pointy hoods? The hoods are properly called capirotes. They were used in medieval Spain by the same secret societies that spawned the penitentes. Capirotes can still be seen today in Holy Week celebrations in Seville and other Spanish towns. Long experience combating heresies, such as the medieval Cathars, made the Catholic Church suspicious of lay organizations, especially those that met in secret. So in the 14th century, Pope Clement VI penalized participation in such groups. In turn, their members adopted the mask capirote, or hood, to hide their identities. Inquisition enforcers retaliated by forcing those caught to wear a faceless capirote. We'd recognize that today as the dunce cap. In the centuries to follow, the capirote was adopted as ritual attire by many secret orders, including some Freemasons. But the pointed hood wasn't standard attire among the original KKK. Nor were white robes. They didn't burn crosses either. The initial Ku Klux Klan was formed by six ex-Confederate officers in Pulaski, Tennessee, in late 1865. Their original aim isn't clear. Some say it was to carry on the Confederate cause. Others think it was more about good old boy hell-raising. The founders drew up a loose set of rules based on two defunct orders, the Sons of Malta and the college fraternity Kuklos Adelphon. Kiklos, the ancient Greek word for circle, morphed into Ku Klux. The Sons of Malta and the fraternity were both influenced by Mardi Gras traditions, like silly names and costumes, from New Orleans and Mobile, Alabama. However, others insist the Klan was really the strong-arm branch of something older and more secret. The Knights of the Golden Circle, or KGC. The Knights of the Golden Circle surfaced in the 1850s. They championed the preservation of slavery through Southern secession. Ultimately, they envisioned a huge slavery-based empire embracing Mexico, parts of South America, and the Caribbean islands. Though it sounds like something conjured up by a gaggle of plantation owners who'd overindulged on mint juleps, the KGC actually originated in the Midwest. It was the brainchild of a Cincinnati physician named George Bickley. The KGC had more influence in the Midwest and Texas than in the Old South. Knights of the Golden Circle were prominently involved in the Confederate invasion of New Mexico during the Civil War and the bloody guerrilla war that raged in Missouri. Among those KGC stalwarts were Frank and Jesse James. Later stories held that the KGC plotted to kill or kidnap Abraham Lincoln, and that it was the hidden hand behind the assassination by KGC member John Wilkes Booth. A sensational book, An Authentic Exposition of the KGC, Knights of the Golden Circle, published in 1861, claimed that the KGC was the moving force behind the whole Confederacy. Another part of the KGC legend is that the Knights squirreled away troves of gold and silver to finance a future uprising. Roots-wise, the KGC borrowed freely from other secret orders such as the early 17th century Rosicrucians in Europe and the subsequent Knights of Pythias, and above all, the Freemasons. The Knights of the Golden Circle were ruled by an inner secret society, the 33. In that, some see a thinly veiled reference to the Masonic Scottish Rite. There are even claims that the Klan was an appendant body of Freemasonry. Everyone's favorite evil Masonic mastermind, Confederate General Albert Pike, was allegedly the dark influence behind the KKK and Knights of the Golden Circle. But Pike's membership in either society is unsubstantiated. Then there's the argument that the first Ku Klux Klan was mostly a fantasy created by frustrated federal military commanders and nervous Republican governors who were unable to control the violence sweeping the post-war South. For instance, in the weeks before the election of 1868, more than 2,000 people were killed in Louisiana alone. Newly enfranchised black freedmen bore the brunt of this violence, but there was plenty of score settling and random killing to go around. The original Klan lacked any coherent organization or leadership. Its name was freely appropriated by common criminals and feuding neighbors alike. The KKK's Grand Wizard, Nathan Bedford Forrest, became so disgusted by the mess that he quit in 1869. Organized or not, the original KKK sparked the first anti-terror legislation in U.S. history. In 1870, a federal grand jury labeled the Klan a terrorist organization and began issuing indictments. The following year, Congress passed the Enforcement Acts, which mandated federal authorities to protect voting. By 1872, the original Klan was dead. But secret societies seldom just roll over and quit. The Klan spirit lived on in new societies like the Red Shirts and the Knights of the White Camellia and the Democratic Rifle Clubs. The latter posed as sporting clubs that just liked to hold shooting tournaments next to polling places on election day. The second Klan, the one that really formed the KKK as we know it, appeared in 1915. Its inspirations were a book, a movie, and a murder. In 1905, a North Carolina minister and writer named Thomas Dixon Jr. penned a novel called The Klansman, with a C. Dixon painted a romanticized picture of the Klan for a new generation of readers. He invented the most iconic of KKK rituals, the cross burning. Called the Cran Tara, or Fiery Cross, it was an old custom from the Scottish Highlands to summon clans to battle. Dixon's novel sought to justify segregation and the Jim Crow laws taking hold in the South. Despite protests that the book was grossly inaccurate and inflammatory, The Klansman was a hit and adapted as a popular play. Filmmaker D.W. Griffith adapted it again for his film Birth of a Nation, which opened in February 1915. This popularized the fantasy of a heroic Ku Klux Klan from sea to sea. 2 years earlier, in Atlanta, Georgia, a 13-year-old factory worker named Mary Fagan was brutally murdered. Suspicion fell on her boss, the factory manager, Leo Frank. He was Jewish and, worse in the minds of many, a Yankee. Frank was also a member of at least one fraternal society, the Jewish B'nai B'rith, or Sons of the Covenant. They rallied to his defense, but to no effect. In a gross miscarriage of justice, Frank was convicted of murder and sentenced to death. The shock of this stimulated B'nai B'rith to create a new body called the Anti-Defamation League, which is still very active today. In June 1915, Frank's sentence was commuted to life in prison. That sparked his abduction and lynching, organized by a new secret society calling itself the Knights of Mary Fagan. It was no gang of angry yokels. Its members included past and present governors, mayors, legislators, and sheriffs. The Knights of Mary Fagan and the visual extravaganza of Birth of a Nation caught the imagination of an unsuccessful Georgia businessman named William J. Simmons. Simmons was already a member of at least a dozen secret societies. Now, Simmons decided to form his own. On Thanksgiving Day, 1915, he and 15 companions climbed Stone Mountain near Atlanta, where they burned a cross and proclaimed the birth, or rebirth, of the invisible empire of the Ku Klux Klan. Their professed aim was the betterment of man. The first Klan had been based purely on Confederate revanchism. It hated Yankees and black freedmen, but was indifferent to Jews, Catholics, or much anyone else. And it had no special interest in bettering mankind. William Simmons' Klan wasn't exclusively or even largely Southern. It became a national phenomenon with strongest appeal in the Midwest and West. While preserving contempt for blacks, the second Klan expanded its hate list by feeding off the social militancy, moral self-righteousness, and fear of foreign influences unleashed by World War I. These new Ku Kluxers touted themselves as champions of prohibition, though most Klansmen weren't teetotalers. By the mid-1920s, the Klan boasted millions of members. The start of its decline was connected to another murder. In April 1925, the Grand Dragon of the Indiana Klan, David C. Stevenson, was arrested and later convicted of the shocking kidnapping, rape, torture, and eventual death of a young woman named Madge Oberholzer. The Indiana Klan was one of the biggest chapters in the country. Stevenson, as Grand Dragon, posed as a paragon of moral virtue. When his belief that he was untouchable proved wrong, he turned on the Klan and aired its dirty laundry in open court. The spell was broken. The Klan's reputation sank. Still, spin-offs emerged. One of the oddest was the so-called Black Legion, which started in the 1920s as the Black Guards, a kind of inner security force of the Ohio Klan. With the KKK's decline and the advent of the Depression, the Black Legion became independent. Its activities were mostly limited to Ohio and Michigan. The Black Legion's membership included a large number of law enforcement officers, including the police chief of Detroit. The Black Legion preserved the Klan's hatred of African Americans, Jews, and Catholics, but focused hostility on labor organizers and labor unions. That fueled speculation the Black Legionnaires were secretly funded by manufacturers like Henry Ford to crush unionization. Despite its fearsome reputation, the Black Legion had some of the silliest regalia ever conceived. Their black robes weren't so strange, but the headgear was. In place of the Klan's pointed hood, they wore a masked pirate hat adorned with crossbones and skull. Imagine Captain Crunch in a long dress, and you pretty much get the idea. Active for only a few years, the Black Legion made national headlines and spawned two movies, Legion of Terror, 1936, and Black Legion, 1937, the latter starring Humphrey Bogart. The inspiration for the films was yet another murder. This time, the victim was an organizer for the Federal Works Progress Administration, Charles Poole. Black Legion thugs abducted and killed Poole on the trumped-up charge that he beat his wife. In fact, she was in the hospital having a baby. Subsequent investigation led to the conviction of 11 Black Legionnaires for the murder. The third version of the Ku Klux Klan, still around today, arose after World War II. It was mostly a response to desegregation and the civil rights movement. It never became a unified national organization. More like the first Klan, it was a loose collection of secret societies roughly sharing the same name and ideas. In the 1980s and 90s, a wave of younger and more politically savvy leaders, like white supremacist David Duke gave the Klan fresh energy and publicity. The same period saw younger Klansmen join forces with skinheads and neo-Nazis, a move that probably would have horrified William Simmons and his foreign-hating brethren. But the history of American secret societies is much, much more than the KKK and its ilk. The vast majority of these brotherhoods, while always selective, generally strove to be socially beneficial and good citizens. Many offered group insurance and death benefits to members at a time when such perks weren't available elsewhere. One example is a group known as the Improved Order of Red Men, originating in the 1830s. Lodges were wigwams and chapters tribes. The women's auxiliary was called Pocahontas. Grand lodges were reservations. The Red Men traced their origins back to the earlier fake Indians who'd carried out the Boston Tea Party, the Sons of Liberty. Ironically, real Native Americans were banned from membership until the 1970s. Still, the most influential fraternal order in America remained Freemasonry. Its supposedly nefarious influence had sparked a national reaction, and the short-lived anti-Masonic party in the 1820s and 1830s. But in the following decades, Freemasonry's acceptability grew. During the Civil War, lodges issued members Masonic certificates. In the event of capture, the holder was commended to the care, sympathy, and good fellowship of brother Masons on the other side. Freemasonry became the union card of the American upper and professional classes. Catering to special interests, side orders or appendant bodies also emerged. Probably the best known is the ancient Arabic order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine, or simply Shriners. They were partly an outgrowth of an obsession with Orientalism gripping European and American society during the late 19th century. In 1870, a wealthy New York Freemason named William Florence visited France. One evening, he was invited to an exotic entertainment hosted by an Egyptian diplomat. He and other guests even went through a mock initiation into a secret society. Or maybe it was a real one. Back at Manhattan's posh Knickerbocker Hotel, Florence enlisted a dozen more well-heeled Masons to establish Mecca Temple, the first lodge of the Mystic Shrine. Initiation was restricted to Master Masons who'd completed the Scottish or York rites. Exclusivity added to its mystique. In time, however, membership would grow to tens and hundreds of thousands. The Shriners' motto was fun and fellowship. To offset a reputation for rampant carousing, they founded their first children's hospital in 1920. Maybe the most interesting thing about the Shriners is that they're a kind of fake Islam. Prayers are offered to Allah and oaths are taken on a Quran. All tongue-in-cheek, of course. And that imitation inspired its own imitators. In 1889, a group of Master Masons in upstate New York formed the Mystic Order of Veiled Prophets of the Enchanted Realm, dubbed the Grotto for short. Their headgear was a black fez as opposed to the Shriners' red one. The Grotto mimicked Islam with a twist. The black fezes bore the image of their patron saint, Mokanna, the Veiled Prophet. Hashim al-Mokanna was a real figure from 8th century Central Asia. He was a Persian mystic who led a revolt against Arab domination and Orthodox Islam. Mokanna offered a strange mixture of Shiism, old Persian Zoroastrianism, and Gnostic mysticism. Some even think there's a connection between the Veiled Prophet and the later Order of Assassins who terrorized the medieval Middle East. Oddly, al-Mokanna shows up as the mascot of another American secret society, the Veiled Prophet of Khorasan Society of St. Louis. It was formed in 1878 by a local merchant and ex-Confederate officer named Charles Slayback, mostly as a ripoff of New Orleans' Mardi Gras. The Veiled Prophet Society was reserved for St. Louis's social elite, but there might have been more going on beneath the pageantry. An image of the Veil Prophet from 1883 shows an armed figure that looks eerily similar to a robed Klansman. That aroused suspicions that the society was another secret remnant of the KKK. The Veil Prophets also borrowed rituals, including reading passages from the Bible backwards, from an old Scottish secret society called the Horseman's Word, which had long been associated with witchcraft and devil worship. There were also Black Shriners. They appeared in Chicago in 1893. To distinguish themselves from White Shriners, the African-American version was named the Ancient Egyptian Arabic Order of the Nobles of the Mystic Shrine. And if there were Black Shriners, there had to be Black Masons. Black Freemasonry goes back to 1775 Boston, where a free African named Prince Hall and 14 companions were initiated into a British military lodge. Later, they formed their own lodge, and Prince Hall Freemasonry was born. Prince Hall Masons were accepted by the Grand Lodge of England, but mostly deemed irregular or clandestine by American lodges. But not all Prince Hall lodges were black. Irish Catholics and Jews, also restricted from most regular lodges, found their own Prince Hall lodges. Other oath-bound orders were incubators of black nationalism. One was the African Blood Brotherhood, which sprang up in Harlem in 1919. Secrecy protected its activities from the eyes of hostile authorities. Headed by journalist Cyril Briggs, the Blood Brotherhood gradually moved away from separatism and merged with the Communist International in 1922. American Freemasonry inspired several outright competitors. The most direct was the Knights of Columbus, basically Freemasonry for Catholics. Founded in New Haven, Connecticut in 1882, the Knights of Columbus mostly attracted Irish and Italian immigrants. That led to overlapping membership among the Knights, the Ancient Order of Hibernians, and the Revolutionary Fenians. The Knights of Columbus were also a mutual benefit society. Some Masons saw the Knights as a threat. For instance, in the 1920s, a rumor circulated that Knights of Columbus initiates took an oath to exterminate Freemasons and Protestants. Another quasi-Masonic society was the Knights of Pythias. It first appeared in 1864. Pledging friendship, charity, and benevolence, the Pythians copied the Masons right down to the 3 degrees, but called their lodges castles. Pythians traced their origins to the ancient mysteries of Pythagoras and the fabled friendship of Damon and Pythias circa 400 BC. They also created a side degree called the Dramatic Order of the Knights of Khorasan, which was yet another nod to that pesky Veil Prophet. Then there was the Independent Order of Oddfellows. The original Oddfellows had appeared in England in the 18th century, side by side with the Freemasons. No one really knows why they became odd. Originally known for drunken revelry, like other orders, the Oddfellows turned to mutual aid and charity. The American, or Independent Order of Oddfellows, appeared in the 1840s. The Oddfellows also followed the Masonic template. A fellow earned 3 degrees dubbed Friendship, Love, and Truth, and could become a patriarch in a higher rite called Encampment. By 1900, Oddfellows outnumbered Freemasons in the United States. Their lodges tended to be more blue-collar and less snobbish than many Masonic ones. Many Oddfellows were linked to labor unions. In 1851, Oddfellows even started admitting women as equal members. While Oddfellows and Masons were to some degree rivals, they weren't mutually exclusive. Franklin Roosevelt, Earl Warren, and even Albert Pike were both Freemasons and Oddfellows. American secret orders reflected the diversity of U.S. society, including its strengths and its flaws. If some reveled in drunkenness, others, like the Order of Rechabites and the Good Templars, existed solely to battle demon alcohol. Secret societies played a very important role in American society. Their biggest appeal was to the wealthy and the middle class, but countless poor benefited from their philanthropy. Secret societies were in many ways America's first social welfare system. Still, some argue that there's something fundamentally un-American about them. John F. Kennedy, in a 1961 speech to the American Newspaper Publishers Association, said, "The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings." And look what happened to him.